So this is the first day of our four-day retreat here in January 2012 at the Franciscan Center in Tampa. And we are talking about walking the walk. And that walk being the path of the Bodhisattva. So over these next three or four days, we are going to be spending a significant amount of time learning various types of meditational practices that facilitate us at a deeper level, having the capacity to walk this path in a meaningful way. I've asked three or four of our members, I could have asked many others, to share various of these meditations during our formal meditation periods. You also got a little handout. We don't usually give out handouts, and that's to keep in your room, to keep with you, because there is downtime here. When you're in your room, outside, in the evening, when you may want to do your own reflection and having an outline of the teachings and practices may be meaningful. Is this on? So those of you who have know me know that I enjoy nothing better than sharing with you the teachings of great masters from the Buddha on down for the last 2,500 years, sharing their wisdom and their understanding, their teachings, their practices, their experience, because they are the best. And I usually don't talk about myself because I am not so. But I thinking upstairs in this walking the walk of the Bodhisattva path, maybe I will share a little bit of my experience, only because I think I've learned in this lifetime by meeting others who do walk the walk. And I think, you know, in the meditation tradition, especially, the role of the teacher, the master, guru, lama, you know, many different terms, is very essential. Because even though we live at a time where in the teachings of the Buddhas and the great masters of all the various Buddhist traditions are still available in print, we can read them. So the Dharma is alive in that way. The Buddha as an historical person is acknowledged in history, so he can be studied as a person. The teachings of the masters can be studied. It can be an empty capsule if we do not really see with our own eyes and our own felt experience that it can be lived. This is what is essential. Because when we meet someone who is living it, not just talking it, but is living it and expresses it in their actions and their interactions, we know at the truest level, deepest level, that the Dharma is true. Right? All of us have met many people who are very facile in their words. And often people have great intelligence and capacity to speak eloquently on significant matters. And yet we often see that in their capacity to live them, there is a vast discrepancy. I think that what that breeds in us is kind of a discordance right? Where we really at a deep level think, oh, these are wonderful ideas to talk about, to think about, and maybe to somewhat get a little inkling of, but they cannot be lived in truth, right? It's only when we meet a living example of truth that we know it is readily livable, because we're encountering a human being who's just like ourselves. We see they don't fly, they don't walk on water, they're like us. We see them, running to the bathroom, we see them eating, we see them aging, we see them dealing with their own difficulties in life. And so that lets us know that people, ordinary people who deal with ordinary circumstances can, through really wholeheartedly putting these practices and teachings into their lives, transformation, awakening, enlightenment, enlightened living is possible. So that is why, I remember one of my Tibetan teachers expressing this in a very simple way. He said, Fred, which is more valuable to you? The greatest book in the world that holds all the essential wisdom, or your teacher who taught you how to read? Oh, I get it. Right. So the living teacher is the one that shows us how to practice, explains the teachings to us, and in a very personal way teaches us how to put them into practice in our life. And so in that way, the living teachers have to be highly respected and regarded, because without them, again, all the greatest books and all the greatest knowledge and learning and et cetera could be available to us intellectually, but we really won't know how to practice them. I began my practice in the late 60s. I can't really say that outwardly I was suffering greatly. Looking back, I was only in my 20s, which seems awful young at this point to even think about such matters. But for some bizarre reason, that's what was happening. But I knew there was something missing in my life. And that even though I had, in a certain way, good life, good friends, good relationships, good loved ones, there was something missing, there was something more. And I somehow knew that the problem was me. And that it, the whatever dissatisfaction was within me was my own creation, and therefore had to come to my own solution. I also, because it was the 60s, and that was a time of great social upheaval in terms of civil rights and war, there was great awareness of social suffering. And even though I had been involved as a student in those movements, and involved with many, many people who had, I would say, good values, wanted a better world, wanted a peaceful world, wanted a loving world. For some reason, it was clear to me that ideas weren't enough. Beliefs systems and value systems weren't enough. They had to be lived. And the only way I found where really focusing on teaching people how to live according to meaning and value and purpose was where? In the religious spiritual world. Those were the people who were dealing with those things. I hadn't known that. So anyhow, one thing or another led me to Zen, because Zen at that time seemed to have dealt with what I wanted to deal with, dealt directly with the mind, and dealt directly with awakening from all constriction, and held out the promise of freedom and openness. And that was very clear at the community that I practiced, was that what it was all about. So it was a Zen Buddhist practice, it was Mahayana Buddhism, and even though we took vows of you know, liberating all sentient beings, and compassion was talked about, really only one thing was practiced, and that was meditation. And everything was, the whole emphasis was on personal awakening as an inner transformative experience, what was called Kensho. And even though, without going into it, there was much benefit from that kind of practice, I saw very much the same thing I had seen in the social political world, was that relationships, interrelationships, were not valued, and the whole interpersonal communal side of things was not really understood or dealt with. There was some great belief that that when one became enlightened, which means one had insight into the nature of reality, nature of self, that somehow compassion and love and all good things would naturally flow forth. But I didn't see it. And as well as it became very clear to me that missing that whole part of work, self-work, that often you could be having various kinds of insights and quote-unquote meditative experiences that only serve to bolster self, bolster ego. Somehow intuitively I felt that's not what this is about. Luckily, at that time, I came across a copy of The Path of the Bodhisattva. It was an early translation. It was not a good translation. And by Shantideva. How many people here are familiar with Shantideva? Okay. So mostly everyone is. And those of you in our community know that we study him, and we practice him, and we see this as the... as kind of the core teaching of our community. Shantideva, all I can say is put it all together. And really brought into place that compassion, that love, that service to others, right? Was as essential and core to the practice as was meditation, wisdom, insight, etc. It wasn't, what I've been getting up to then was, you know, wisdom and meditation is the core, and sort of compassion sort of comes later. It's kind of like the icing on the cake. But what you get in Shantideva was, no, it is essential. It is part of the transformation that the practice of giving up self-cherishing, egoism, egocentricity, and learning to love and cherish others greater than oneself is the practice of non-self. The practice of non-self is not just a meditative experience, right? It's not just an intellectual insight. It's something real, and it is expressed through selflessness, right? And then one didn't have to wait for full enlightenment to practice selflessness. One didn't have to wait to full enlightenment to develop love and understanding and compassion for others. Luckily, in the mid-70s, so I found this book, and I thought I'd found some kind of ancient Buddhist text, right, that some academic had translated. I had no idea that it was anything other than that, you know. There was just, I felt fortunate to find it, it sort of reinforced some of my own intuitions about practice. But then in the mid-70s, I was fortunate enough to encounter Thich Nhat Hanh and meet him and spend time with him. And there it was. You know, there it was. Here was a Zen monk. He was a man of steeped in the meditative traditions, the wisdom traditions, and yet he was manifesting as this loving, compassionate man who was living a life of service. He wasn't living in a monastery. He was living in an apartment in Paris. He was totally dedicating himself to the cause of his people, to the cause of the nonviolent peace, Buddhist peace movement in Vietnam, that was spending his time dealing with refugees and pen pals and offering help whenever he can, and was a very sweet man, a very kind man, a very open man, a very curious man. It was quite wonderful. It was proof that the Bodhisattva tradition was alive and being lived. And he was just a human being who was doing it. So I won't go into it other than say that was very significant to me in my path, in my walking. Then next, after I left France, I went to India. And I first went to, I might have told this before, forgive me if I'm telling it again, but my wife and I at the time arrived in India. Anybody who's flown to India knows you because of time change, you often arrive, like 2 in the morning, 3 in the, 2 in the morning, and you go through Delhi. Probably one of the best times to go through Delhi. There's not a lot of traffic and whatever. But anyhow, it came into Delhi in the middle of the night. And for some reason, we went to this place called the Ladakh Budvihar. I can still remember it was on the river. And it was basically a place that Ladakhis, sort of a Tibetan-type people, stay in when they come to New Delhi. It was more of a rest town, very kind of primitive. But anyhow, we ended up there at 3, 4 in the morning. Of course, everybody was asleep. We were just hanging out. 5, 6 o'clock, people began to show up. And anyhow, as the morning progressed, somebody showed up, a young Tibetan man who spoke some English. And he found out what we were up to. And when he heard that we were there for Buddhism, he said, "Oh, you have to come and meet this teacher." And so he took us into this little dark room. And I can still remember him. His name was Nechung Rinpoche. So he was the first Tibetan Lama that I had ever met. And he walked in this little dark room, and I think it was lit by candlelight or something. Anyhow, he was sitting there, and he had... all I could say is his skin had a golden hue to it, and it was like it was glowing. And he had a shaved head. And you notice the Buddhas, all Buddhas have this little kind of top thing. It's Ud-us? Well, I don't remember the Sanskrit word, but it's a little... what? Then, yeah, us something. But anyway, it's that little protuberance sort of shows that, they're awake, that chakras has been... so anyhow, all Buddhas, iconographically are shown with this little protuberance. Well, he had this little protuberance. I mean, he had this little thing at the top of his head. It was quite, these long ears, like a Buddha. It was sort of like I'd stepped into another world, because I'd only practiced in America up to then. I was an American Buddhist. I didn't really do nothing of traditional Buddhism. And Thay was the first kind of non-American Buddhist I met. But Thay was very, he was very open. He was very different. He didn't present himself at that time in any traditional way. This guy was definitely traditional. And he kind of asked some questions, and we had this guy translating. you know, why we're here, we're on pilgrimage, blah, 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 blah. And he, good. And then he started telling us Jataka tales. Do people know what the Jataka tales are? The Jataka tales are this collection of stories of the Buddha in his prior lives. They're really quite wonderful. There are many of them. And they're called the lives of the Bodhisattva, which meant that before he was a Buddha, before he came to full enlightenment, he had many lives where he was perfecting himself. Many of those lives, he was an animal. You don't know these stories? Oh, they're wonderful. Like the story of the hungry tigress, just to give you an example. In that case, he wasn't an animal. In that case, he was a young prince. He's out in the forest with his buddies. He's got their bows and arrows. They're on a hunting party. And all of a sudden, they encounter a starving tigress. And they see this emaciated tigress. And right by her are her cubs. And obviously, she's so weak, she hasn't been able to hunt, you know, which means kill. And therefore, she has become too weak, so she doesn't have any milk, so she cannot feed her cubs. And the Buddha, who at that time was one of these young men, his heart just opened to her. And the suffering of this mother who only wanted to feed her children, but had no capacity to hunt. She was so weak. So what he did is he saw above her was like she was at the bottom of a cliff. So what he did, he climbed up to the top of the cliff, and he jumped off. So he would fall and die right in front of her, so she could eat him. And in eating him, she would therefore get energy, develop milk, and be able to feed her young. Now you may say, what a story. But there are many, many stories like this which showed, again, from the point of view of what we're talking about, the path of the Bodhisattva, that the training of the Bodhisattva is not just in meditation, wisdom, insight, concentration, mindfulness. The training of the Bodhisattva is in selfless deeds. Right? Because to do something like that, how many of us could do that? Right? So anyhow, there are other stories. They go on. They're very quite wonderful, Jataka's tales. Anyhow, so this monk is telling me a couple of them. This Rinpoche, he's telling me a couple of them. And then he looks at me, and he says, these stories are true. These are not just stories. This is actual things that the Buddha did in his past lifetime. And then he looked at me and he said, but don't you do them. You're not there yet. I mean, it was quite interesting. He kind of knew me right off. He said, the Buddha didn't do it because he thought about it. The Buddha didn't do it because he was practicing altruism. The Buddha, did, you know what I mean, in that left. He did it because as a bodhisattva, he had attained that place where it was a natural, spontaneous response to suffering. And he says, a fully enlightened person will do that. Someone asks them for an eye, they'll pluck out their eye. They won't even think. Ask them for an arm, they'll give them an arm. It's a little extreme. But he said, you're not there yet. If somebody asks you that, don't do it. But he said, you can begin to do small deeds, small actions, to benefit others. So that was good. That was a good first meeting. And then the next step, we went to a dharamsala, you know, where the Dalai Lama is and the Tibetan, largest Tibetan community there, and where there was a Tibetan library where they had a wonderful geshe teaching Westerners, specifically set up to teach Westerners. And all of a sudden, as I began to attend teachings there, I found out that Shantideva, you know, this kind of book I had discovered, not that I thought I was the only one who knew about him, but I thought, you know, only existed like an academic. He was taught there. And that he was, I mean, he, at the center of their tradition was the teachings of Shantideva, the text, the Path of the Bodhicaryatara, and that it was actively, actively studied and practiced, you know. It was quite a wonderful experience to find that out and to meet people that was the centrality of their practice. And to meet very developed practitioners. I mean, I always thought that you went on retreat simply to meditate, right? To do single point of concentration, to practice insight, to practice, meditative topics. And I met practitioners who would go in on retreat just to do meditation on compassion, the faults of self-cherishing, 6 months a year, looking deeply into issues of self-centeredness and what that's all about. So it was quite instructive to me to come in touch with a living tradition in which the practices of compassion, the practices of non-self, the practices of selflessness were not just dressing, were not just, side shows for the real show, you know, but that were core and central to the teachings. And then I was very fortunate to spend some time with a wonderful teacher, to live with him, and to really see how a bodhisattva lives. Again, as I say, I think, and I'm sharing this with you because maybe perhaps some of you have not had these kind of experiences. Because these days in the West, while much teaching is available, most of the teaching that gets transmitted these days gets transmitted through books, through videos, through DVDs, through attending workshops or retreats where you're one of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And you get the, Dharma becomes a little bit theater because you're always seeing it staged. But many of us have not had the experience of living with our teachers, to really see them day to day. To me, that is, for me, the most instructive teaching that I've received in this life, because it has allowed me to see very intimately how an enlightened person lives their life with such integrity. And it's made what you often see as teachings that we are exposed to in these public settings, but they don't have that intimacy, and they don't have that personal meaning when the transmission is one-to-one. So that is why I'm taking the time today to share these just few experiences with you. So my time in northern India with a teacher by the name of Dzogchen Rinpoche was also quite wonderful. As opposed to Thay, who was sort of out of his element. In other words, he was a Vietnamese, but he was living in Paris and very much involved in service and social work and political work, very different than as he is now. Dzogchen Rinpoche was fully embedded in his community. So it was a very different kind of experience I had to observe him. He was a monk. But he was living, he was an abbot of a monastery, he was building a large monastery, he was also There was a large Tibetan lay community that lived around the monastery that he was actually had been appointed. He was the president of. Only laugh because the Tibetan community was so factionalized, they couldn't get along with one another. So even though he had, that's the last thing in the world, he had enough going on as the abbot of the monastery that he was building from scratch and educating these monks and young monks and all that. He had also become president of the community. Let me tell you about Dzogchen Rinpoche. To me, I felt I was living with a Buddha. Again, not because he walked on water, not because he flew through the air, but because his activity was totally selfless. Meaning there was no thought of self at all. I want to tell you a little bit about him, but as I say that, I'm reminded of he was so busy, having to deal with so much. And one day I said to him, Rinpoche, do you ever, I forget how exactly he said it, but it was sort of like, do you ever want to just get away from it all? You know what I mean? Just so much activity and responsibility and work and no end to it. Do you ever just want to go off in a cave in the mountains and just meditate, and or even just take a vacation? How about a vacation? And I remember it was quite striking to me because he looked at me with incomprehension, as if that thought had never entered his mind. And he just very simply said, "No, I'm a bodhisattva. My life is all about taking care and helping beings. This is it. This is what I'm here for. This is the job I signed up for. This is what I've been trained for." Again, it wasn't, as I say, the words. It was, I just could see that the thought of it has never entered his mind. There was absolutely no separation, no resistance to what I perceived as an incredibly difficult life. Right? Because I lived in his home for a while, I was able to observe him. Every morning he would be up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Right? And Tibetans do mantra practice, prayers, silent practice. So I was staying in a room right next to him, so I knew he got up at 3 o'clock because I'd hear him. And from 3 to 7, he would do his practice, 4 hours of practice. From 7 on until 9, 10 o'clock, it was whatever came through the door. And what came through the door was everything. Right? It was the most mundane dealings of the monastery. Decisions to be made about this and that. Money, all kinds of money decisions. He was constantly hustling poor man for money. Nothing for himself. He lived in one little room. But he, coming from Tibet and having his glorious monasteries and everything totally destroyed and lost everything, he only wanted to, rebuild and create a home, so the traditions could be recreated. So he was always hustling for money any way he could, and he'd get it here, and right away it'd be gone. He kept nothing for himself. He was, so his endlessly, he had craftspeople all over the place, painters and mask makers and jewelers and silversmiths and goldsmiths and carpenters and all over the place. And he was overseeing the whole thing. He was overseeing the education. Again, the community, all kinds of social problems, dealing with government, Indian bureaucrats. it was nonstop, as well as, you know, people would come to him for Dharma teachings, people come to him for blessings, people would come for him to, for divination. They do these mows, you know, should I go sell my sweaters in this place or that place? Should I take this medicine or that medicine? You know, my water buffaloes have wandered away. Do you think they've gone over to the north or the south? I mean, they endlessly, right, for healing, for non-discrimination, right? He just, whatever came to him, there was no resistance at all, right? No resistance, no self. I remember one day this young guy shows up, roars up on a motorcycle, zoom, 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 young Tibetan guy. Jumps off the motorcycle, comes into Rinpoche's house. Would Rinpoche come out and bless his motorcycle? Well, so afterwards, again, you know, one of the advantages of being a Westerner in a situation like that, you know, I could get away with asking. All the Tibetans were very humble. You know, they would never ask. You know, all they do is listen and do whatever he says. But being a Westerner and being curious, and you know, and I think they enjoyed that because they never really got that. So I would question everything. So again, on that day, this teenager roars up with his new motorcycle, asks Rinpoche to come out and give a blessing for it. Rinpoche, of course, does. And I say to Rinpoche afterwards, Rinpoche, I mean, you know, teaching Dharma, you know, but blessing motorcycles, you know, I mean. And again, it was like, his answer was, this young man, his trust or faith in Dharma is where it is. Right? That's the way he relates to Dharma. It's something that will protect him. Right? It has no real depth, but it's the beginning. You know, and so we meet beings where they are, and we help them where they are. If he wants, if it makes him feel more secure, if the motorcycle is blessed, of course. Will bless it. Am I giving you a sense of a mind? Right? I've told this story before, and I'll tell it again, because again, it was one of those instructive stories. I'd left India, and when I was in there, he had asked me to bring something to a well-known Tibetan teacher who was from the same sort of Tibet with him, and they had kind of grown up somewhat together, but he was now here in the West and teaching. And they communicated back and forth. And so I went to see him, and when I was talking to this teacher, he said to me, you know, when you go back to India, you tell Zona Rinpoche. I think what he's doing is foolish, wasting all that time building this big monastery in India. I mean, he said, Dharma, you know, it's destroyed in Tibet. You know, it's going to be destroyed in India, you know, in America, this is where it's happening. I'm just paraphrasing. And I've told him he should come here and teach here. Tell him, you know, he's just wasting his time there. India is going to go communist eventually. And, you know, what happened in Tibet, they'll just tear it down. And, you know, all his work is for vain. So when I got back to India, I told Zona Rinpoche exactly what, because I was interested to see what he would say. So I can remember him. He stopped, and he reflected, and he said, he may be right. Yeah, he said it could very well be that perhaps one day, like in China, communists could take over, and they're very anti-religious, and they could, they could come. I think it's a mob of them could come to this monastery, and they could tear it down brick by brick. And then he said, and if that gave them happiness, then I would be happy. If that gave them happiness, then I would be happy. He said, if people see this building, this temple, this monastery that I'm building, and think it's about the building, they don't have any understanding of what this is about. He said, from the beginning, the only thought in my mind has been, may this benefit beings. You know, my only thought in my mind is to restore the teachings and the practices of Dharma so it can benefit beings. That will not be destroyed if the bricks and mortar are destroyed. Again, that kind of response, it's not very practical, is it? It's not very attentive to the bottom line, is it? But I share that with you to understand that Dharma is very different than our materialistic way of viewing life. Right? Shantideva, our noble teacher Shantideva, many of us are in our second 6 or 8 month intensive on him and his path of the Bodhisattva. The path of the Bodhisattva, his book, is a compendium. The whole path is there. All the 6 paramitas, from generosity, patience, mindfulness, right conduct, meditation, wisdom. All the 6 paramitas, the path of the practices of the Bodhisattva, are all very clearly and profoundly and simply presented. But before he even gets there, he talks about intention. And if there's anything that I heard over and over and over again, everything we do has to be for others. Right? Not just as a afterthought, not just as a sugarcoating, but because that is the very essence of awakened view. So Shantideva spends a lot of time in the beginning of his teachings talking about bodhicitta. Right? Anybody not know bodhicitta? Don't be embarrassed. Bodhicitta is easy to say. Bodhicitta. But the meaning is profound. Bodhi is enlightenment. Bodhi is awakening. Bodhi is the wisdom that knows the nature of reality. Bodhi. Right. Sattva is that being who wants to attain and realize enlightenment for the benefit of beings. You know, in the development of Buddhism, as you know, those of you who've looked into the history of Buddhism, we know that historically we see at least two main currents, which are often called Hinayana, Mahayana, small vehicle, large vehicle. People familiar with those terms? No? Anybody not? Four Noble Truths, right? Eightfold Path. Small vehicle. Right? It's about suffering, cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and how I go about it. Right? Small vehicle. One person. Me. Right? My own liberation. The three marks of existence. Right? Impermanence. Suffering, and not my non-self. Small vehicle. Very helpful to help me free myself from my suffering. Wonderful teachings. The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence, 12 Links, Interdependence, right? Dependent arising, all these basic teachings of Buddha are all called Hinayana, small vehicle teachings. Not that they're not profound, but they are one person looking at their situation, right, and wanting freedom and liberation from it. They want to stop suffering. They want to be happy. And so, therefore, there are these teachings that very clearly allow them to do that. Right? Small vehicle, Hinayana. But then, within Buddhism, there is another strain called Mahayana. Right? The great vehicle. The Bodhi Mahayana is also called the Bodhisattvayana. Right? In the Mahayana, we step out of ourself. And we look around. And when we look around, we notice what? That I am not alone. Right? I am not the only person who suffers. Actually, if truth be told, everybody to one degree or another suffers. Right? It is a condition of this life. People I love suffer. People I hate suffer. And people I'm indifferent to suffer. It doesn't matter whether I like them or dislike them or indifferent to them. They are in the same condition that I am. Right? And that is the truth. So the Hinayanist, and when I say Hinayanist or Mahayanist, please understand I'm not talking about Theravada, Vajrayana, you know. To me, those kind of labels are irrelevant because I have met in the Theravada tradition Bodhisattvas, and I've met within the Mahayana tradition Hinayanists. Because it has to do with aspiration. And the aspiration is not just on words. You know, people say, because I take the vow to benefit all sentient beings, to save all sentient beings, I'm a bodhisattva. Absolutely not. In that case, parrots could be bodhisattvas. Right? Right? You could have a whole, you know, whole aviary, a whole sangha of parrots and macaw. I mean, all these talking birds, right? You know, all, you could say, this is my bodhisattva sangha. Look, they all want to help others. We laugh because we think it's ridiculous to think that way. Because we know what? If it's not put into action, right? If it's just mouth, it doesn't really have any significance. So when we talk about Mahayanas and Hinayanas, we're really talking about level of aspiration and intention. Again, even though we recite things here that we could say are in the Bodhisattva tradition, please understand that's just a recitation. It has to be lived if it has any meaning. So, when one looks around, when one looks around the world, when one looks around one's home, when one looks around one's family, one's neighborhood, one's workplace, one sees what? That people are just as caught up in stuff and suffering as I am. And if I only thought about myself, if I only thought about my own liberation, that's just another form of what? Selfishness. Self-centeredness. Egocentricity. So we know that there are lots of well-meaning people in religions and social work, nonprofits and all kinds of things who have good values and good intentions but act from a place of self. And when one is acting from a place of self, one's altruistic actions often become contaminated. And so therefore we often find in nonprofits, social welfare agencies, religious social movements, etc., the same type of ego games, conflict, right, that you find in, we could say, organizations that don't have those kinds of values. Why is that? Because people are practicing for themselves and not practicing for others. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says what? I am here for you. How many of us wake up every day and say that to ourselves? Today, everyone I encounter, I will be there for. No. We operate in Everybody I encounter, I'm going to see what I can have them do for me. Right? Because we have our agenda. Our agenda is what? Me. Like me, love me, respect me, need me, want me, care for me, don't hurt me. Right? It's all about me. I was talking to somebody earlier who was talking about, or maybe a few days ago, I forget. I was talking to somebody and they were saying, coming to retreat brings up anxiety for them. Right? They're going to meet people. They don't know people. Are they going to be accepted? Are they going to be liked? Are they, you know, right? It's often called social anxiety. Right? But from what I'm talking about now, you can understand that if I live in the world of self, when I encounter a situation, I'm encountering that situation thinking what? About self, right? Who's looking at me? Who's ignoring me? Who's noticing me? You know what I mean? It's all about me. If you're practicing non-self, you walk in and you look around and you notice everyone else and you go, you know, who can I talk to? You know, who can I help? Who can I relate to? Who can I care for? Who can, right? It's a totally different... The way of self is the way of constriction. It's the way of walls. It's the way of narrowness. It's the way of looking out through the people who's there. Danger, you know, right? The Bodhisattva is a very different character. The Bodhisattva has made a commitment to openness. Right? Why? Because the Bodhisattva has vowed to benefit all beings. Well, you can't benefit all beings behind a wall. Right? You can't benefit all beings if we're only thinking that the teacher was labeled benefiting myself or protecting myself. Right? I mean, where's the benefit in that? Right. So the Bodhisattva makes the commitment to absolute openness. I will be open to every situation. I will be open to every person. Because I want to what? I want to be of benefit. Why do I want to be of benefit? Because I have committed myself, right, to living a life for others. As I said last night, two choices in this life. Live for myself, live for others. Right? Now that sounds big, but, you know, it comes down to life. Every situation we're in, you know. Am I going to be open to others' point of view, or am I just going to listen to my own? Am I going to be present to other people's needs, or only present to my needs, right? Which is it? It's a choice. The Bodhisattva, you know, we use words, Bodhisattva path, they're just words. But what they mean is that in all my interactions, the reference point is no longer me. Right? For most of us, the reference point for all our experience is me. Right? Most of us go through life going, what? How can I advance me, right, in this life? Right? How can I get ahead in this world? How can I get more of this, more of that? Right? I mean, again, a lot of it's just ordinary stuff, getting jobs, getting relationships, you know. But it's all about me. How do I take care of me? How do I keep me safe? Right? How do I make me feel good? How do I get happiness for me? Right? You know that one? Yeah. there is another way. That's what Buddhism is about. That's what the Bodhisattva way is about. There is another way. You know, this way, as Shantideva says, is not known, is it? How many of you heard about the way of the way of the Bodhisattva, the way of love and compassion, the way of selfless awakening, the way of totally dedicating your life to the well-being of others? How many of you heard about that from your parents? Anybody was at the conversation at the dinner table growing up? It's not to say that we didn't get some good instruction from our parents or whatever. They weren't decent people. But we didn't hear about this, right? Did you hear about it in grade school, middle school, high school, college? You know? No. This is a rare teaching. And it's even rarer because of what I'll say next. Because what we have been taught, instructed by our parents and by our society, is that if we live a life for ourselves and advance ourselves in the way that we're supposed to advance ourselves, right? We will then be what? Happy. Right? We will then be happy. We will then be safe. We will then be secure. But the truth is what? That's not what happens. It doesn't mean that there's not lots of good things in this life, and there are not happy moments and happy experiences and positive things. I mean, I'm not painting a bleak picture. Over the course of these next days, we'll be doing meditation on the what's called the faults of self-cherishing. That a life that is egocentric, which means based on me, the I, the self, and always meeting its needs, is not the path to happiness. We have been told a lie. And all you have to do is look around you in our country to know the truth of that. I won't belabor it. When I was traveling in Asia, the happiest people I met, biggest smiles, most carefree, most at ease, were people living in caves, in retreat. You know, I go up in these places in Tibet and India to meet these retreatants, these hermits, these communities of laymen and laywomen or monks and nuns who are living in retreat. Nothing. Living in caves or little huts, right? Big smiles, at ease, right? I remember once meeting these wonderful nuns. They were outside their little huts roasting potatoes in a fire. And they offered me one of their potatoes. It was a delicious potato. What a delicious potato that was, after walking for hours and being hungry. And they were so happy. And they loved that little potato, too, that they were eating. Right? We think we need so much to be happy. Not only things, but we think we need so much stuff from others to be happy. We think happiness is in getting something and not giving. So the Bodhisattva path says the opposite. It says when you let go of self, when you let go of living from self, you really enter into the world of happiness and ease and peace and meaning. Which means everything we do when we're on the Bodhisattva path, we do for others. Right? We're attentive to others. Now, somebody might say, but, you know, aren't I supposed to be taking care of myself? How about me? Right? What about my suffering? Has anybody been thinking that? Sounds a little codependent, just always wanting to take care of others. I'm going to say that I believe that much, if you look deeply at your suffering, much of your psychological, emotional suffering comes from your egocentricity. That without a strong self that needs and wants and demands and insists, much of our sadnesses, much of our fears, much of our angers, resentments would not even arise. Problem solved. When we are angry with somebody, right? When we are angry with somebody, we are what? We're angry with them because why? Because they're not doing what we want. They're not treating us the way we want. They're not saying things to us that we want, or they're saying things that we think they shouldn't say, or, right? All of that is about self. Right. I mean, there's lots of ramifications to self and other. But we need to, you know, fear. I am afraid what's going to happen to me. Try to be afraid without a self. Right? It's hard. What you'll find is that most of your afflictive emotions are based on I. Now, I is an interesting term, by the way. Right? When I give the term I to this, it becomes mine. Right? When I give the term you to all of you, you become different than I. Right? So now we are separate. And my concern now is for that which I am calling me. Because I am labeling you as different than me. Is that clear? Now, what if I turned that around? What if I called you me? What if I called you me? What if I called you I? Right? So when Twi was suffering, I said, oh, I am suffering. Then what? Oh, I am suffering. When Doug is suffering, oh, I am suffering. When Twi is happy, I go, oh, I'm happy. When Doug is happy, I go, I am happy. Try saying that. It's just words and labeling. We divide up what is essentially one and whole and indivisible and interdependent and all this stuff, and we go, no. Me. You. Me Tarzan. You Jane. Maybe that's where it began. We thought it began with Adam and Eve, but maybe it began with Tarzan and Jane. Right, look at that. Very primitive. Me, Tarzan, you, Jane. We separate. I want you. Did Tarzan say that? He didn't say that. The Bodhisattva extends the I to everyone, equally as concerned. Right? So for those of you who are worried about yourself, that you'll be overlooked, you're part of it too. But you're just part of it. When we live in self-cherishing and egocentricity, we're everything. We're 90%. And everyone else is 10 or 20. Right? But when you live in bodhisattva awareness, just the same way you want everyone to be happy and to be free of suffering, you also want yourself to be happy and free of suffering. So it's not as if you overlook yourself, right? But you understand that yourself is just another self, like everybody else. As the Dalai Lama always says, Thich Nhat Hanh says what? Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. That's our great commonality. Right? Poor people want to be happy, don't want to suffer. Rich people want to be happy, don't want to be suffering. Black people, white people, brown people, right? Men, women. Everybody's the same. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. Right? For me, only to be concerned about my happiness and ending my suffering is still being totally ensnared in what? Egocentricity. Again, even if I accepted that as my working hypothesis, it will not work. Because to live in selfhood with all its accoutrements of advancing and defending, of needing and wanting, of attaching and avoiding, you know, those are all strategies, you know, all those things that we heard about. Those are all strategies of a self trying to find comfort. Right? If I can just get what I want and get rid of what I don't want, right? That's my strategy. Right? And then when I get it, I'm going to be happy. Right? That's my strategy. That's self-strategy. And mostly, I think everybody in this room has been working that. vary some more than others, different ways. That's the strategy we've been working, right? Since forever. What if you didn't have a strategy like that? The Bodhisattva has only one strategy. What's that strategy? To benefit others. How can I be of help? How can I be of service? Right? Now, coming back to may I attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So in this Bodhisattva path, there is this wonderful intention, this wonderful heart, this wonderful thrust of altruism, right? Selflessness, compassion, service, right? Right? I get it. Nancy goes, I get it, yeah, yeah. But how do I get from here to there? Right? Oh, the other part of the path. Now I understand. Mindfulness. Concentration, insight, patience, moral conduct, right? The Eightfold Path. Oh, yeah. I have this great inspiration, right, for living this kind of wondrous, selfless, meaningful life. But I need tools, right? To put those tools into practice and to realize them is to be enlightened. Right? Oh, I want to benefit so many people. I want to be of help, but I can't. I'm still ensnared in this pitiful little guy who just wants to be loved and taken care of, and wants everybody to like him and love him, and he wants to feel safe and not be scared, and you know, like this. He's a baby. You know. So I have this wonderful, wonderful, marvelous aspiration, right? But I'm just a big baby. So I have to grow up. How do I grow up? Oh, Buddha Dharma, right? Teachings. Now, that helps me grow up. Becoming enlightened. You know, I was a therapist for most of my life, and it was very clear to me that in my field, American mental health field, the exemplar of a developed person is somebody who what? Copes well. Right? That's it. Somebody who copes well. A good coper. That's the model. Right? Let's help people learn to cope with life. Right? And successful people who cope well with life. Compare that to the vision of the Bodhisattva, what life's about. Compare that to being a Buddha. And please understand that being a Buddha, being a Bodhisattva, is not something unattainable. I mean, the reason I wasted your time this morning sharing with you some stories is to let you know, these are real beings. And I could go on, and probably everybody here has stories. You know, it's just really about willing to live it. Right? I mean, you know, you've heard me say before, Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, if you meet them, you meet what? You meet another human being. That's all. Two eyes, a nose, a mouth, right? Legs, arms. You know. What's so special about them? Two things. Their mind and their activity. Enlightened mind, enlightened activity. How'd they get there? They practiced. They didn't receive some kind of supernatural, esoteric, metaphysical transmission. They practiced. They still practice. It is said in the teachings that every fully enlightened Buddha began simply with an aspiration. All those mighty oak trees out there began with a seed. How big was the seed? Next time when you go walking in the afternoon and look at those trees. Big, solid. They all began with a seed, that big. How can a seed produce something like that? Because that seed, even though it is tiny, has the full potential of that tree. Right? You see the seed, you see the tree. But how did that seed become the tree? Practice. Right? The seed had to what? Lots of seeds. Wind blowing lots of seeds, blowing all ways. Not every seed becomes a big tree. Right? How did those seeds become that big tree? Causes and conditions. Causes and conditions. So each of us has the seed of bodhicitta, the seed of enlightenment, in our minds. Right? Everyone does. Practice is knowing that and then consciously cultivating. If you want a beautiful garden, you could just wait and see what grows. Anybody garden like that? I'll just wait and see what grows. Hopefully something very beautiful will grow, lots of flowers that I like. I'll just wait. I'll be patient. Years go by. The weeds get higher and higher. But I have faith. I'll wait. Lifetime after lifetime, the weeds keep growing. I got another plan for you. Simpler. You go to the store. You buy the seeds or the seedlings you want, right? You plan out your garden. You take them home and you read the instructions. You plant the full sun in the full sun, the partial in the partial, the shade in the shade. You see how much sun they need, how much water they need, what kind of soil they need, how much fertilizer they need, right? And you take good care of them. Take good care of them doesn't mean you check in with them once every 3 years. Even once a week. Anybody who's a gardener here knows you can't often wait that long. Every day you want to check in your garden. I assure you, barring extraordinary circumstances, if you follow the directions on the packet, and you plant them and take care of them in the right way, you will have that garden. That's conscious cultivation of what you want. Each of us have the seeds of awakening, the seeds of compassion, the seeds of love, the seeds of understanding, the seeds of patience, etc., etc., in us. Practice is what? Cultivating. Those seeds, right? Please. please, but please remember, each of us has the other seeds. We have the seeds of judgment, we have the seeds of anger, we have the seeds of hurt, we have the seeds of impatience, we have the seeds of fear, we have the seeds of resentment, right? Please be careful. As Shantideva says, that that's not what you're cultivating. Because if we're cultivating that, that's what will grow. So, this thought of enlightenment, this wanting to be awake, so one really has the capacity to benefit others, one wants to be free, so one can truly be happy. It is now just a seed. It is now just a tiny seedling in each of us. Right? It is through practice. Loving, consistent, caring, deliberate intention. Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama, good gardeners. They cultivate seeds. They hothouse them. That's all. They don't lay about. Is that clear? Are there any questions about what's been presented today? Any arguments? Please, is anything not clear? Yes.
Well, we all know people who have lived the life of compassion and caring and giving and taking care of others and have come to the realization that they too are very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
They say they forgot about themselves, and that they're just as miserable as the me, me, me. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I would say that's not true. I would say the first part of what you said is true, Tony. There are many people who have done their best to lead good lives,
yeah,
cared for others, been loving to others, helped others, been compassionate, helpful. Lots of good stuff in this life. But your second part, why are they so unhappy still?
Yeah.
And I'd say because they only had half, Tony. They didn't have the enlightened side. They didn't have the liberated side. They didn't really have the non-self side.
Okay.
To me, that is what I think is so special about this path. Because I think what you see, at least in the West, is a very strongly developed tradition of service, good works, that's very powerful. But it is, somewhere along the line, it got separated from the path of insight and wisdom and understanding. And so you see they kind of went off in separate directions, right? And so over here, you see just that. Lots of good intention, lots of good efforts, but still so much suffering in that person. Okay, and over here you see lots of wisdom, lots of insight, lots of intellectual understanding that's kind of cold, kind of detached. You know what I'm saying? What to me was so unique about this bodhisattva path is it brings them together, and that's important to understand. I mean. You probably all know this. You hear that, the bird, the two wings of the bird, compassion and understanding. A bird cannot fly with one wing. So we hear in the Bodhisattva path, and that's, again, in my earlier talks about Zen, and I'm not saying anything bad about Zen. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh is a Zen Buddhist. So, but if you only have one wing, you can't fly. And that's, I think what you said is a true comment, but a sad comment, because these are, we will meet and maybe we're in here in this room, good people, right, with good hearts and good intentions, and do their best to do good. And yet, and again, it's because that other piece, that piece of understanding, that piece of really understanding self and non-self and duality, you know, really having that inner cultivation is not present. So the bodhisattva is someone who brings that together, right? So is able to act endlessly, you know. As I said, you know, when I watch, look at Thich Nhat Hanh, right? What's he, 85 years old? Still trucking, right? Still going around. I saw him in Hanoi. I hadn't seen him in 10 years. And I just sat through 6 days of retreat with him. First thing he says to me, I'm still giving the same teachings, aren't I? You know, that I heard 20, that I, he says to me, you know, that I heard that I was giving 20 years ago. And he said, you know, they just don't get it. So I got to keep, you know, I just got to keep repeating myself. What a bodhisattva, right? You hear Thich Nhat Hanh, he's given the same teachings he gave 20 years ago, still is fresh, same stories, you know, even though he has a new one. You know, same story, same anecdote, same, it's wonderful, and yet totally fresh. You know, he's a bodhisattva, right? Still trucking. Thich Nhat Hanh. Why? Why? Does he need the money? Fame and fortune? No. He's deeply in touch with human suffering, right? And he wants to help. Wants to help. That's the motivation. What sustains him? How come Thich Nhat Hanh hasn't burned out after all these years? How come the Dalai Lama, you read about the Dalai Lama, his life, same thing. Endless, right? You know, I mean, one day he's teaching Dzogchen Mahamudra, Nagarjuna. You know, the next day he's, he's doing some political thing. The next day he's giving some academic thing. The next day he's, you know, he's visiting some refugee settlement. Or he's giving the Kala Chakra. I mean, he's just like endless, right? Endless. For what? For what? Because he cares. He wants to help sentient beings, and he knows that he has the medicine to offer to cure what ails beings, right? Why doesn't he burn out, right? Why isn't he cynical, depressed? I mean, look. I mean, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, right? 20 years, still giving the same teaching. I mean, most of us would have gotten frustrated and the hell with these people, you know, right? Just going to go back to France. Good cheese, nice, good fruit, right? I'll just enjoy my life in southern France. That's the way most of us would go. And yet, bodhisattvas leave, they're not about comfort. They're not about safety. They're not about privacy. They're not about separation. They're about openness. They are not disturbed by the mess of the world. Most of us, we are disturbed by the mess of the world. Bodhisattva understands the world's a mess, right? You know, my job is to do what? To do my best to clean it up. I'm on the cleaning detail, right? That's all. You know, it's so simple, isn't it? Bodhisattvas, they hear there's a mess, they go, okay, I volunteer. That's my expertise. Cleaning up messes. Most of us go, oh, I don't want to, it's a mess. Can't you give me something that's not messy to deal with? Right? So this is our beginning. As today, the meditations will begin. We need to take it deeper than intellectual. We need transformation. We need to get it. When we get it, and the motivation is coming from within, and the inspiration is within, and the clarity is within, we just move along. But when it's up here, and this is still being driven by egocentric thoughts and egocentric behavior and ego needs and self needs, there will always be struggle, there will always be conflict, there will always be affliction. So, again, the reason I told you the stories today was to let you know that this path can be lived authentically. Many people do live it authentically. It has been lived authentically for thousands of years. And you can do it too. Anybody think they cannot? Thich Nhat Hanh says, well, you know, you know, his statement, one Buddha is not enough. That's just kind of one of his latest things. You know, traditionally in Buddhism, you know, every kind of world system gets one Buddha. You know, like Shakyamuni was ours, 5,000. Then Maitreya is going to come. So traditionally in Buddhism, you know, for every world cycle, there's one Buddha. Then there are these bodhisattvas, but only one Buddha. Thay says, these days one Buddha is not enough. he inspires us to become Buddhas. So this world is a mess. It needs lots of Buddhas. So here we have 35, 36 Buddhas to be. It's just about making the commitment. Grow your seed so it can flower. Simple as that. When you go do your walking meditation and you look at those trees, think tiny seed. The same. That's why we say sentient beings and Buddhas, the same. No difference.